Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're here basking in the warm glow of the Seahawks' 23-15 victory over the New Orleans Saints today in the divisional round of the NFC playoffs to reach the NFC Championship game next Sunday.
And we're excited to talk about this game, but before that I want to talk about maybe the context of the game. Where do you think that this game ranks in victories in the Seahawks' history?
I mean, it's tough for me to place the 1983 team's run in context since I was 1 year old at the time. But I think of modern Seahawks victories, it's behind only the championship game in 2005.
It's pretty much number two.
Yeah.
Maybe the game, the victory against Washington that took them to the championship game in 2005.
No, because I don't think that was as big of a showdown as this game was. The NFC wasn't quite as deep that year. I mean, New Orleans is a really good team.
Well, so we've concluded one of the best games in Seahawks history, or one of the most important games in
Without
Seahawks history, at the very least. So really excited to talk about it, and let's dive into it. I was at the game, and so if my voice is shot, excuse me, but you probably will know more about specific plays than I will, just because it's kind of hard to pick up on kind of what's going on. I understand more of the tenor of the game, but you'll understand more of the specifics of the game than I will. But let's start with Percy Harvin.
Well, he was involved immediately, as advertised, targeted on two of the game's first three plays for the Seahawks, and then went out briefly with a possible concussion, came back to the game, made a big impact, and then suffered a concussion and had to leave.
So you texted me, Percy out, and then momentarily after, you texted me, Percy back.
Yeah, what was going on Twitter was people were saying that his helmet had been taken away, and that, it turned out, was just part of the concussion protocol and going through the checklist and checking him for one. So then he was able to come back out to the sidelines, got his helmet back, and returned to the game pretty quickly.
And then what about his impact on the field? So he was pretty much involved for three or four plays. The first play that he was in, he came in, it was very noticeable that he was in, and they kind of forced a throw to him. Russell forced a throw to Percy on a quick screen, and there was nothing there.
Yeah, I mean, it was designed for a screen, and just the blocking didn't hold up as well as you would hope in that play. You saw a variety of different things. I think it's more than even just the times he was targeted, because a couple of times, and I don't know how well you can tell this, at the game, they had package plays set up to potentially throw the ball to Harvin in a screen situation. And what they were doing is they were running that off of a read option play fake. So that's very similar to what the Eagles have done this season. You see it a lot in college football, and it's obviously something that, you know, we talked about this before the game. They had these 2 weeks to prepare for Percy Harvin, and that, it looks like, was the big thing they worked on.
They were very, very well prepared to incorporate Percy into the offense. The play that he got, this was probably the biggest impact that he had in the game, aside from drawing the penalty where he had the first potential concussion, was an end around that Percy got and picked up a first down on it. It was the fastest I have ever seen a player run.
Not an end-around, though, a fly sweep. And so it's similar to what Oregon State used as the basis of their offense a few years ago. The Huskies have used it quite a bit at various times over the last 4 or 5 years, but we've never seen the Seahawks run it. It's very rare in the NFL game. It was very effective.
When he ran it, it was the craziest thing I've ever seen. I'm not joking. Seeing him run, and I've been in a lot of NFL and college games, and he's faster than Reggie Bush. I mean, my recollection of this is probably 10 years old from Reggie Bush, but he was faster than Reggie Bush, faster than Chris Johnson, faster than anybody I have ever seen play on that play. It was very apparent how important and how skilled Percy Harvin is just right from the beginning.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think what we saw in the time he was on the field was exactly why the Seahawks made this move in the first place. He is a unique talent. There are, you know, two or three guys in the league with the combination of athletic skills and tools that Percy Harvin has. If that, he may be the only one with quite that package. And it did make an impact, especially on third down, whether he was targeted or not. You know, early in the game, the Seahawks were, I believe, 5 of their first 8 in converting third downs, including a couple of penalties, the targeting on Harvin being one of them. And then after he went out, they only picked up 2 third downs the rest of the game.
And so talking about the offense in general, it definitely stagnated after Percy went out. They had 16 points with him on the field, and since he went out, they had 1 score, and that was the long touchdown from Marshawn Lynch. But what were your general thoughts about the offense?
I think it, again, it goes back to Harvin. I really thought that in the first half, Darrell Bevell was dealing close to a perfect game. He was keeping, the New Orleans defense off balance. He was one step ahead of them, mixing in the run, the read option, the pass, Harvin, a variety of things. And it was all working very well. And then after he left, that's when we saw something similar to the last, 2 weeks or maybe even 4 weeks of the regular season, depending on how you look at it.
And just speaking about this from being at the game, I think that in the second half, some of the tenor in the crowd really turned ugly, honestly. There were boos that came in. I was saying at the game, I was like, you can't boo a team that is about to go to the conference championship game. It wasn't widespread, but there was upsetness when they had a series where I think that they passed the ball first, second, third down, and instead of incorporating Marshawn into the offense in the second half. And some of the play calling was kind of confusing in the second half, and I think that they maybe were continuing with the game plan that they had designed with Percy on the field, but he wasn't out there to draw the defense in that same way. Because when Percy was on the field, it seemed like he was drawing attention, and Golden Tate was really open for a lot of quick hits.
I would say it was a streamed-down version of what they were trying to do. I mean, they took those plays out entirely, so that left them with a smaller base with which to work. And, a lot of this is, it's results-based. So they run the ball on third and six, as they did at one point early in the third quarter, after picking up a couple of third downs on Marshawn Lynch runs, and then people complain, oh, that's a really conservative call. Then, you have the scenario where they pass three times, and you say, well, why didn't they run? So a lot of it is, it's just whichever thing happens, I'm going to complain about the opposite. But at the same time, the third down calls were not very good. There was a lot of slants that Russell Wilson was not sharp on, and guys weren't necessarily getting separation.
Do you think that was because of the weather or because of Russell Wilson, or what was going on there?
I mean, it's not that different than what we saw against Arizona, so I don't think it's stunning at this point of the year. It's just expected to maybe see a little more creativity with that, and that is what we saw with Percy Harvin on the field, but not in the second half.
Honestly, I have to give a lot of credit to the Saints in this game, though. I thought their defense played exceptionally well, and I think that they played really similarly to how they've played all season, which was they didn't defend the run all that well, and they gave up the big plays to Marshawn Lynch, especially the touchdown that basically won the game at the end of the game. But they defended the pass really well, and they kind of shut down everything that Russell Wilson was looking for,
A couple of things here. First off, on the run, I thought what was really interesting is in the first game on Monday Night Football, the read option was there several times for Russell Wilson. So this time, you could see that New Orleans had game planned to take that away, but it turned out it left open some running lanes for Marshawn Lynch, and I don't believe Russell Wilson kept it one time all game.
I was saying, there were times, actually, when we were watching the game, I was calling out the read option, and
you gotta call that out.
I think that there were times where Russell Wilson should have kept the ball and instead handed it off.
I mean, I think that his philosophy, and I think the Seahawks probably endorse this philosophy, if not are responsible for it, is if it's close, I'm going to hand it off.
Yeah.
I'm only going to keep it if it's wide open and I've got a relatively safe chance to pick up yards and try to potentially avoid a hit. So, it's a little tough to say without watching the All-22 or going through a replay of everything. I've now become a coaching snob because I've had the NFL Total Readout for a week now. But it seemed like New Orleans linebackers were in position and they were just relying on, the rest of the team to shut down Marshawn Lynch. And they weren't necessarily creating running lanes for him in those situations where they were able to stop it.
But Marshawn had an excellent game. Definitely, I think, the player of the game for the Seahawks.
Offensively, yeah.
I would give him credit. And the touchdown run that he had at the end was really exciting. There was an extended hug that happened. I believe that we hugged and jumped up and down in the crowd.
Those are always the best moments.
So that was fun.
It really was like there was a goal the entire time to create a Beastquake Part 2, and people tried to assign that to his first touchdown, which came off a read option. It was an impressive play, but obviously the second one that basically finished the game was...
That was really the closest to a Beastquake, and that was the closest crowd response. It was the biggest crowd response that we've gotten from any moment all season, probably any moment of the last two seasons, because that was the biggest play that we've had in the last two seasons at CenturyLink.
Now, can I tell you a weird, disappointing thing about the game?
What was that?
Twitter is now ahead of the broadcasts.
Really?
There's such competition among the Seahawks beat writers to tweet that on both of Marshawn Lynch's touchdown runs, I happened to be sitting on Twitter and saw that they were TDs before the play actually
occurred. There's one pretty easy way to rectify this problem.
Well, yeah, but I, you know, I want to follow things on Twitter and share my own thoughts from time to time at Cape Elton. But yeah, it's a little bit of a tough thing. I don't know if NFL, if broadcasters are going to have to adjust to this.
That's interesting. And definitely not a problem I have being at the game.
No, not an issue.
Nobody was out-tweeting the live game.
If they did, that would be very impressive. Nostra Tristan would tip his cap, his imaginary cap.
Okay, so let's talk defensively for the Seahawks. What did you see there?
It was very good. It was surprising that they had so much success running the football. One of the things that came up on Twitter was that teams had been effective against the Seahawks late in the season using 22 personnel, which is two running backs in the backfield and then two tight ends. And we saw the Saints use that a lot. But I think a lot of it was just, you know, they blocked very effectively. Kyrie Robinson and to a lesser extent Mark Ingram, other than his fumble, ran the ball hard. And we saw some missed tackles that weren't there the last time these two teams played.
I felt like the one thing, honestly, it looked like, as far as the run game went, they looked like the Seahawks from the middle of the season that couldn't defend the run particularly well, and it was those cutback runs that they were getting, that they were really getting killed on mid-season, and they came back to kill them again. Kind of counters, or maybe it was just Robinson, Ingram finding the right holes, but cutback runs against those linebackers, and maybe this has something to do with KJ Wright being out and Malcolm Smith being in and not filling those holes, but they did exceptionally well in those plays.
I mean, the weird thing in making it a trend is the Seahawks did a phenomenal job against the run in Week 17 against St. Louis, which was one of the teams that had gashed them in midseason. So I don't know if there's a trend here necessarily, but, you know, they did a great job of running the football. It just came for naught because, A, Drew Brees struggled with the elements, somewhat predictably, in the first half, and then, B, the Seahawks secondary, it was really possibly their crowning game, I feel like.
You think it was the best game for the Seahawks secondary all season?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Brees ends up with 300 yards because he was able to throw so much in the second half and in the fourth quarter in particular, but to shut out the Saints for three quarters and to shut out Jimmy Graham without a catch for three and a half quarters, that's a really impressive effort.
Yeah, I mean, the secondary was all over the place. They had a few big plays that would have meant that Brees would have thrown for a lot less than 300 yards. A few interceptions that were dropped. Cam Chancellor dropped one. And then Earl Thomas dropped one that ended up going for a 52-yard gain, Robert Meacham.
Yeah, kind of similar to the Auburn-Georgia play that won Auburn that game.
So I think that that was probably bad luck, and it's not something that I would expect would continue. I mean, maybe when you're throwing the ball 43 times, eventually you're going to get a couple breaks throughout that time.
Yeah, especially as you're good as the Saints. I don't think it's something to worry about. We also saw some softer coverage in the second half, and Marcus Colston in particular was able to kind of sit down underneath that and make some short to intermediate plays in the passing game. But, you know, I don't think that they were able to really pick out Byron Maxwell at all. He had a very good game. The safeties played well. The linebackers covered well. I think it was just an all-around impressive effort.
I thought all of the secondary played really well. They were all over everybody. There were a few situations where the Saints were able to find receivers crossing across the field, and those tend to be the routes that they couldn't defend.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think, no matter who they're playing next week, the Seahawks really have to pay attention to, because I think either of the teams that they could play can really exploit that.
Yeah, and you're always going to leave some sort of vulnerability. There's no such thing as a perfect defense, but again, for the first three quarters, the Seahawks were pretty close. And they got the benefit of the fact that Brees airmailed some throws, struggled with whether it was the rain and the slickness or it was the wind, which is what he seemed to indicate in the halftime interview to Aaron Andrews. He just was not sharp early on.
And then what about special teams? When you look at special teams, did you feel like Seattle had an advantage there? Obviously, Shane Graham missed the two field goals, but any other places?
Well, I think a differentiator in the game, which is kind of what we expected going in with the Seahawks being one of the best special teams units in the NFL and New Orleans struggling in that area of the game. And, you know, Thomas Morstead, their punter, actually has been one of their strongest contributors over the course of the year, but he had that dropped punt where he ended up shanking it on the first punt of the game, and that really set up the Seahawks with terrific field goal to get an opening field goal. Oh, terrific field position to get a field goal. And then obviously the two missed kicks, and, you know, just in general, the Seahawks had the upper hand there.
Yeah, that first shank that he had on the punt, I mean, it started out, the game starts out, and I think we should talk about this next week on the podcast when we have a little bit more time, about the Seahawks when they get the ball first versus being on defense first.
Absolutely.
And how much better they are on defense.
How much more comfortable it makes us feel.
So, also as fans. But a lot of things all went right for the Seahawks right in a row. They're on defense first. They get the stop on the first possession of the game, then the shanked punt, and then the field goal subsequently. And it was kind of like, wow, everything is going right here. This is the perfect way that you could have started this game. I mean, maybe scoring a touchdown would have been better, but all of those things went right for the Seahawks.
Yeah, and you put New Orleans in a position where they were playing from behind the entire game. The one thing I wonder about is how much more conservative the Seattle offense got as a result of that. Would we have seen something different in terms of them opening it up if they hadn't been just protecting the lead and relying on their defense?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing to talk about. And turning to next week a little bit, how the elements were a factor in this game. Because I think that a lot of fans are going to complain about the Seattle offense, and that's already what we've seen online, is that people are concerned about the Seattle offense, complaining, upset about the play calling, upset about this and that, and being really concerned with whether Percy Harvin is coming back. But the elements are a two-way street, and the Seahawks are, in general, a defensive team. So it means that the offense might not run as smoothly as we'd like it to, but it also means that no matter who they play, whatever they're looking to run is not going to be as easy as they want it to, and it especially helped them out this week playing against the Saints and somebody like Drew Brees.
Yeah, it'll be different next week because you're facing against a more like opponent, whoever wins that Carolina-San Francisco matchup. But the other thing is, the decision-making tends to be conservative. I mean, there was a situation where Russell Wilson had the scramble where he came up a yard short of the first down. It was very close to
picking it up. I would have liked for them to have gone for it.
Could have gone for that. But Pete Carroll's going to rely on his defense every time there, and they ended up pinning New Orleans deep at the 5-yard line, and, you know, it worked out.
So looking at the game that's going to happen tomorrow, Carolina and San Francisco, who do you want to win this game?
I don't really have a preference. I think that they're both really good teams and very similar stylistically in terms of just what they emphasize and what they believe in. So I don't think that there's one that's a better matchup necessarily for the Seahawks than the other.
Looking really quickly at it, I think that I'm cheering for the 49ers to win. I mean, obviously either of those teams would be coming in here. The 49ers had a worse record throughout the season, but also Pro Football Outsiders, they're just generally a worse team. They're a worse defense than the Panthers are. It might be a little bit different since they have Alden Smith back and they didn't have him through much of the season, and then also they're a worse offense than the Panthers have, which again, they have Michael Crabtree back, but throughout the whole season, they played worse than the Panthers, both offensively and defensively.
Which is bizarre, then, that they're favored going into Carolina this week. And it seems to me that people are reading more into that comeback win at Green Bay. Crippled, maybe that's not quite the right word, but limited Green Bay team in terms of injuries. I think the gambling
I'm
public
not impressed by the 49ers victory. Despite the fact that I'm cheering for the 49ers tomorrow, I don't think that they're going to win. But I'm also not impressed with their victory. I can't be impressed with the 49ers ever. I also just, you know, want to beat the 49ers to go to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, that's the wild card here is, you know, them being such rivals, if you beat them, it feels that much better. If you lost to them, it would be that much more painful to have to watch them in the Super Bowl.
That would be really bad.
Think about that. Think about the possibility of them, Jim Harbaugh, getting the NFC Championship trophy on the CenturyLink Field turf.
That would be really sad.
Think about that.
But it was a strange tenor in the crowd throughout the whole game. We had the fans who were in front of us who were season ticket holders. They left in the second quarter when the Seahawks were up 16-0. I mean, granted, that was a nice lead, but leaving then, and every single one of the fans around us left early. It was really strange. The confidence that exists with the Seahawks fans, I suppose, is good, but it was very strange for us being there as fans who would not consider leaving. And then we should also talk about Marcus Colston's play at the end, because how strange that was,
too. Yeah,
I can't believe
you haven't mentioned that.
But how I confidence might be the wrong way to put it, but that people in Seattle couldn't deal with the weather?
I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. First off, you either purchased tickets to this game or you forewent the chance to sell your tickets for at over $100, probably something like $150 for seats that are under some cover, as your guys theoretically are. But
we were undercover, but with the wind.
Exactly. Theoretically being the key word there. So to leave in the second quarter, to me, is just unbelievable. But yeah, it's like there's this weird dynamic, and we've talked about this on the podcast a little bit, but Seahawks fans either are certain that the team is going to the Super Bowl, and I think we can say that now because we're a win away. We can't really be looking ahead at this point.
We can use the SB word.
It's allowable again. either certain we're going to the Super Bowl or, like, just like us, completely terrified at every turn. And there was such a sentiment on Twitter that, like, oh, the game is over when the Seahawks went up 13-0. It's like, whoa, guys, there is a long game left.
Even when it was 16-0, you know, it was only a 2-score game for a lot of the game. And then when the Saints marched down and scored that touchdown and then got the 2-point conversion right after that.
Yeah, I mean, how nervous were you when they got the football back at that point, trailing by 8 points?
Extremely nervous. You know what? I have a lot of confidence in the Seahawks defense, though. And this is one of the points where we're really different than last season. Where last season, if the Saints would have gotten the ball in that exact same situation, I would have expected that they were going to score. And this season, I don't have that expectation.
That's true. I mean, it's, you know, similar to the Atlanta game where the defense couldn't make the stop they needed. Obviously, easier situation here.
Okay, and then Marcus Colston at the end of the game.
Well, actually, let's talk before that. Doug Baldwin.
Oh, what a catch by Doug Baldwin. And
but more than that, the play call to go deep on 3rd and 3. And apparently Russell Wilson was telling the coaches, this is open, please let me throw it.
I want to throw it.
Which, we want the ball and we're going to score. It's kind of like that.
You know, it was the type of thing where I was saying that Sean Payton challenged that play, the catch to Doug Baldwin, that honestly, that was the play that kind of sealed the game in a lot of ways.
Yeah, much more so than the touchdown.
But Doug Baldwin knows how to get his feet down in bounds. Doug Baldwin's gotten his feet down in bounds on a lot closer plays than that one.
Well, for a second there, I was worried because it was that he was bobbling the ball a little bit, but he did secure it, and then he got a knee down. He did not have 2 feet. But
I thought he got 2 feet plus a knee.
I don't think he had 2 feet before when he had control. He was still in the act of making the catch at that point. But it really was a classic Seahawks play. Something we've talked about all season is the red line that they've got painted on the practice fields at VMAC, just a few miles north of us here in Renton. And they teach the receivers to run outside there, and Wilson is going to put the ball where they are the only one who can make a play on it. It's a very low-risk way of creating high-reward opportunities, and it absolutely paid off with a perfect throw and a great catch there.
It was great all around, and that's, again, something that Doug Baldwin is really good at, and Russell Wilson is really good at. They've obviously practiced it a lot, and it's something that, depending on who they're playing next week, probably is not going to be there as easily.
But it's been there much of the season. I mean, we'll talk about that when we start scouting. I've already watched tape of both Carolina and San Francisco, so, you know, they're very good defenses, and they're not going to... But that is what the Seahawks want to do, and there's a philosophical element to the fact that, for all I just talked about them playing conservative in the second half, they went for it in a big way on that play and were rewarded for sticking with what they've been trying to do all season.
Okay, so Marcus Colston on the last play of the game. It was a situation where we're outlining the scenario. So the Saints have the ball and are driving when they're down 15, correct?
Yes.
And I was like, okay, there's a minute 50 left or something like that. And I was like, okay, they need to score a touchdown. They'll probably kick the extra point. These are all of the things that need to happen for the Saints to get back in the game. And why I felt probably more confident, they need to score a touchdown. They need to get the onside kick. They need to score another touchdown. Then they need a 2-point conversion. So they needed a lot of things to happen
without
there.
The benefit of a timeout.
And they honestly came very close to getting a lot of them.
Close.
You know, the defense was playing off them at the end of the game, and that's probably the one situation where the Seahawks defense this season hasn't been that good, is in these situations where they're having to play off a little bit. But
that's the idea. I mean, it took them a very long time to score the touchdown that they did get. So they only got the ball back with, I think, 26 seconds on the clock.
So Marcus Colston catches the ball around the 30-yard line.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking he's going to step out of bounds, as I'm sure everybody is thinking. And then all of a sudden he throws the ball across the field forward. The referee Terry McCauley calls it an incomplete pass, and the game is over because it's an illegal forward pass.
And there's a 10-second runoff at that point. Yeah. Because there was still 2 seconds left on the clock. Yeah, it was really one of the most bizarre finishes to a game in recent memory because they had things set up exactly as you would have wanted them. I always think back to there was a San Francisco-Green Bay playoff game in probably around 99 where Steve Young threw a touchdown pass to Terrell Owens from about 30 yards out. So I've always, in my head, since that play, thought, you get into the 30 and now you can... It's not a Hail Mary. It's actually a relatively normal pass.
No, and for the Saints offense, with Jimmy Graham and experienced receivers, you would think, I mean, first off, you would think that Marcus Colston was an experienced enough receiver to have stepped out of bounds there.
You would think so.
There's no way that anybody was telling him, hey, throw the ball across the field. But But they would have had a very good chance. I would have been very panicked if they would have had a play from there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a legitimate chance. And a lot of things had to go right to get them to that point. Obviously, none more so than the onside kick that bounced off Golden Tate's hands and right into Colston's waiting hands, fittingly enough. So I'm hoping there's some onside kick practice next week.
Yeah. That'll be practice. Nice. You know, if the Saints were playing a game next week, they'd probably have some end-of-the-game practice also.
They probably would.
Maybe next season they'll consider that. But it was a nice gift for Marcus Colston, that illegal forward pass.
The gift of comedy.
to make things less nerve-wracking for the fans. And to take us to the conference championship game in what is one of the three most important games in Seahawks history.
Foremost.
Including the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and count that. Well, they didn't play that one. It was weird.
Yeah. Three most.
It was never held.
Because Super Bowl XL didn't happen.
Yeah. I still do not acknowledge its existence.
Anything else on this game?
I think we've pretty much covered the keys to it.
The meat of it. So we'll be back next week previewing either the Seahawks versus the Carolina Panthers or the San Francisco 49ers in a game that could potentially take the Seahawks to their second Super Bowl.
In the words of Bart Scott, can't wait.